Today is January 15th, 2014, and this is episode number 238 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, extemporaneous estoppel. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
I'm trying to keep from laughing too hard.
I have no idea what I even said.
It doesn't matter. It's going on your business cards.
My business pamphlet.
That's right.
Man, so we're both sick.
Yes.
Because
we're both sick at the same time, people are going to talk. Let's just let them wonder.
Yeah, well, it's all CES's fault.
It is.
We have the CES plague.
We do.
Am I going to even try to like cut out all your coughs?
Yes. But people will be able to tell as you lose more and more interest in doing that, because as the show progresses, you'll start hearing more and more coughs. So to cover for you, what I'm going to say is, wow, considering how much talking we have to do on our show, I bet as we get farther into it, I'll be coughing more.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to pull all those out. But that's what CES does. CES gives you the plague.
It does. And man, we're right there soaking it up so that you guys don't have to. You're welcome.
That's right. That's right. But at least we had a great time.
Well.
Actually,
it was fun.
It was good seeing you. I mean, I know that we're sitting across from each other in the studio right now.
Yeah, but it's great to see each other outside of the studio.
Yeah, without the glass pane between us.
Right.
Right. It was good to see Dave. It was good to let the interns out, to play for a little bit.
Let him piddle in the yard.
Yep. Saw the good folks at Backbeat.
That's always a pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. We met with some cool companies, for sure, doing some cool things. As a whole, I thought CES was a bit of a snoozer this year, but I did have some good meetings with really cool companies doing some really cool things.
You know, I have to agree, it didn't feel like it was as exciting of a show for products this year as it has been in the past. Honestly, I think the most exciting part of the show, of the whole conference for me, there were two things. First was simply trying to get there. And second was having the opportunity to go see Fleetwood Mac live.
You know, that Fleetwood Mac was my first live concert.
No kidding.
Minute Work
Fleetwood
opened.
Mac was my most recent live concert.
It's true. Minute Work opened for me.
There was no opening act.
How was Stevie Nicks?
She was still on fire.
Have you seen that show, The Coven?
I haven't.
It's part of the American Horror Story series.
Okay.
And it's about a coven of witches in New Orleans. But Stevie Nicks apparently recently did not a cameo. Actually, she appeared as herself because there was a witch who was obsessed with her.
Well, that's kind of fun.
It's, yeah.
I can understand the obsession because Stevie Nicks is pretty cool.
Yeah, fair enough. And plus, there was the album cover that she did in the 70s, the Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham solo, the duet album before they joined Fleetwood Mac, where her boob was showing. And that was a thing. That was like a big thing.
That
back
was
in the 70s.
Yeah, I love the music industry for that. For that.
Oh, good times. Good times.
Good times indeed.
Never could get over how Lindsey Buckingham plays the guitar with his finger instead of a pick.
And getting to see him play where they were doing close ups on his hands while he was playing.
Uh huh.
So on the giant screens, getting to see that, I had a lot of respect for him as a guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
I have newfound respect after this concert, because the things that he was doing with the guitar and without using a pick, oh my God, just phenomenal, absolutely incredible.
I wish that I had gone. 'Cause you went with Dave to see that, right?
I did.
Yeah, I wish I had gone too, but I weenied out.
You did, and you missed out on a great show and some excitement, and yeah, you just missed out.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, there's always next year.
There is always next year. Now, we did give out two Editor's Choice Awards at the CES.
We did, and they're both very cool products.
We did. Let me start with the Anki Drive.
No, let's start with the iPort.
Okay.
And that's because I think that there's a lot more whiz bang fun with the Anki Drive.
No, fair enough.
So
so let's start with the iPort.
Oh, I think that's a great idea, Brian.
Okay. Good.
Okay, so iPort, they have this really cool case. Excuse me, for the iPad Air and Retina iPad Mini, that includes a whole charging stand, and if it all fits together beautifully, and it has magnetic charging points on two sides, so the stand can hold your iPad in portrait or landscape mode. It can hold it at three different angles, so you can type on it, use it for watching videos, or use it for FaceTime chat, and it has a 12 volt charger, so it charges twice as fast as Apple's charger, which is really nice, I think. And they put in all these nice little details that just really make it stand out. Like the magnets are set just so that when you drop the iPad into the charger stand, it doesn't matter how you set it; it automatically just slides and snaps into place to charge. It has little acoustic vents to redirect the sound from the speakers forward, and it has magnets built into the side so that you can use one of Apple's own smart covers without having a case that looks lopsided, because there's a cutout where you would set the smart cover.
That makes sense. And what I don't, what one of the important things about this case, and I'm not sure that was clear in your description, was that it charges just by setting the case, setting your iPad down in the stand. You're not actually docking it with a lightning bolt or a lightning connector or a dock connector. You're not docking it. You're just setting it in place, and all the magic of the charging is happening in the case that goes with the stand.
Yes, that is correct, and I didn't do a good job of making that clear. I blame it on the Expo SARS.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, it's definitely, it was a very, very cool product. Definitely thinking different about achieving multiple aims at the same time. You know, because there's the protection from the case. There's the how do you charge something when it's in a case. There's making it work with the smart cover. It's
they thought about a lot of stuff with this.
Definitely. And the other product that we gave an Editor's Choice Award to was the Anki Drive, the racing game, the racing combat game.
Yes. And for those that aren't familiar with this, it was introduced at Worldwide Developers Conference several months ago.
Yeah, in June.
Yes, back in June. And the cars have artificial intelligence. You can control them through your iPhone.
And yeah, when you look at it, you're gonna the first thing you're gonna think of is slot cars.
Right, right.
But these aren't slot. So it's a physical track that you can roll up because it's printed. And they're physical cars, and you're controlling them with your iPhone or iPad. And they race around on this track, but the cars have this camera. So the track has got stuff printed on it for us to see. Where the cars race is black, and there's other stuff that's printed on it too. but there are cameras in the car that see through the black ink to navigational markers that are printed underneath the black ink. And that's how the cars stay on the track. And you're controlling the cars. You're physically controlling these physical cars with your iPhone or iPad. And you're racing around the track and you're shooting at each other. And you've got all these different weapons and different defenses. And it's really cool.
It's very cool. And I love that the artificial intelligence part lets the cars take the instructions that you give them and then work with them instead of just doing a by rote implementation.
Right.
Yeah, it's right. Just it's really cool. So you don't know exactly what's going to happen with the cars as they're going around the track.
No, even though you're controlling them. And it's like one of my favorite weapons is the tractor beam, which will like pull a car that's ahead of you back to you. I think that's fracking awesome. And then they just introduced a bunch of upgrades, a software update that they put out right before CES. One of them has a new mode where the car will do a 180, so you can fire at the cars that are behind you. I mean, come on, that's cool, man.
That's fracking cool is what that is.
It's just cool. It's just cool. And you know, this product shipped in October. They announced that they've had 60 million miles. I'm sorry, 60 million laps, not miles. 60 million laps that their customers have already played. And it was released in October. And, you know, a lot of those sold and were opened in December for Christmas.
Right.
And they've already had 60 million laps raced. That's how much fun this game is. That's how much people are enjoying it. And they're still at the beginning of this product. I mean, who knows what they're going to be doing next?
Oh, I know. It's really exciting.
It's really exciting. It really is. Yeah, I was very pleased to give them that award. That was one of the highlights for me. What else did you see at the show?
Well, I saw lots of wearable technology, what most people are referring to as wearable technology, so like wrist-top computer-type devices. And a lot of that was just really, what's a good way to say it? It felt like there was a lot of desperation on the expo floor.
Glomming. Like,
yeah.
There was a lot of people wanting to glom onto wearables.
Right. And it was very clear that these companies really didn't have a good idea of what it is that they could do with these products. And it almost felt like they were waiting for someone to show them what to make. And by that, I mean, they're waiting for Apple to release something right, so they can copy it.
Right.
The exception was when I started looking at the fitness wearable technology. Mm. And I think the difference there is that the companies that are making products for that space, they have a very clear goal.
Well, they were the first actual usable wearable computing devices.
Yes, absolutely.
So they've got a head start.
They have a big head start, and they have a very well defined goal, and that's important. And right. I think a lot of these other companies, they don't have a goal for the end user.
Right. A lot of the fitness wearable companies are fitness enthusiasts, right? So they're wanting to make a product that they want to use.
Yes. And there's a big difference between making a product you want to use and a product that you hope you can sell.
Yes. Huge difference.
And it was very clear on the expo floor seeing that. That said, there were a lot of really cool fitness tech products out there, and I'm really excited about where the fitness and health market is going for consumers with technology.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, here's one thing to watch for over the next few months. Withings has a new device coming out. It's called the Aura, and it's like an alarm clock, but it includes a lot of sensor components, including a sensor pad that goes on top of your mattress and under the sheets on your bed. And so it's monitoring your sleep patterns, and it can help you to develop better sleep habits, and it can wake you up at the appropriate time. So like smart alarms where they monitor your sleep and wake you up when it's most efficient to wake you up, as opposed to just simply at an arbitrary time.
Mm-hmm.
And it also uses some light therapy, and by that I mean not so much the holistic light therapy. Like if you see this color, you will feel this. You'll be healed in this way, but more like there are certain colors that our bodies are attuned to. Like in the morning, we know what sunrise colors are, and at night, we know what sunset and night colors are. And so it's trying to mimic more of the natural colors that our bodies would be getting if we weren't indoors. So that's kind of cool. And you can also tell it, actually, I just want it to be this color. And it was just a really interesting looking product. And
it's like how much more black can it get? And the answer is none.
Yeah.
None more black.
Right. And, yeah. And it goes to 11. So anyhow, that was just typical of a lot of the health and fitness technology products I was seeing. There's a lot, I think, to get excited about in that area.
Excellent. We saw lots of cases, too.
We saw lots of cases.
There were lots of cases and lots of Bluetooth speakers.
Yes.
On a serious note, there were I did actually hear a good pair of headphones from Sennheiser. I did a cool stuff found on them. Oh golly, now I can't remember what they're called, but I'm waiting to get a copy to review, and I'm pretty interested in that. And then I also got the chance to hear their Orpheus headphones. Did you stop by and listen to those?
No, I didn't. Sadly, I had to skip so many things I really wanted to see this year.
These were on display, complete vanity display. Apparently they made 300 sets of these headphones in 1991 as a proof of concept that they could make the best headphones of all time, or something to that effect. That's what they were telling me. And they had them set up with a tube amp that was designed just for these headphones. And wow. I got to listen to them, and even though it was on the show floor, you know, with your ears dead, it was actually in a room that wasn't soundproof, but it was definitely isolated. And we have sirens. And
I just shudder to think what Sienna and Ainsworth have done this time.
And anyway, sat down and listened to them. I think Pink Floyd's Money was playing, and you know it's actually a song with lots of
stuff. That's a great go-to song for testing headphones. Yeah.
And I heard things that I'd never noticed before. It was a truly fantastic experience listening to those things.
That's awesome. I'm sorry I missed out on that.
So am I. Now, you know, our friend Caroline, who is at Svinge Photography, who has taken photographs for the Mac Observer, in her other day job at ArcSoft, they released a new product called SimpliCam, which is a drop cam competitor.
Oh, okay, cool.
And it's accompanied with an app called Closely that actually, you know, is what you use on your iOS devices to watch what's recorded with SimpliCam. Mm-hmm. And with Closely, it includes facial recognition and facial tracking.
Oh, so it can tell you exactly who it's seeing.
Yes.
That's
which
really
is,
cool.
Which is, according to them, is the first time anyone's actually done both of those things in a home surveillance.
I haven't heard of anyone doing that combination before now.
Yeah, and they're also doing a good pricing on. I think that it's 11 or 21 day packages, which probably I think is better. I think what DropCam does something like one day and 15 days and 30 days. I don't know. whatever. It's a slightly different pricing model that they're using. Mm-hmm. It's a good product. I've been working with a prototype or a pre-shipping unit. I don't think it's a prototype, but I've been working with the pre-shipping unit. It's they're doing a good job with it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. See anything else that was interesting?
Yes, I saw the future of styluses.
Oh yeah?
I did. It's no secret that I totally have a thing for styluses.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And so I had to make a visit to the Adonit booth because they have the new Jot stylus that's like a pen.
Uh-huh.
And it's called the Jot Script. And they're also the company that Adobe has teamed with for their stylus, the Mighty, and then its companion ruler, Napoleon. And so I wanted to talk to them about that. And so, sadly, no exciting new news yet about Mighty and Napoleon. We'll just have to continue to be patient. But for the other products that they're making, what I found out was that ballpoint style tip that they're using on the Jot Script, that's the future of styluses right there. We're hitting a phase now where stylus makers want to give us a feel that's more natural with our styluses, which they've had limited success with before. And so Adonit is going to be taking all of their styluses and moving them towards the small 1.9 millimeter style tip, which tells me that the other stylus manufacturers are looking at doing something similar. And I think we're going to end up with three classes of styluses. We'll have the small tip that is more like using a traditional pen or pencil. Mm-hmm. We'll have the fat tips, which are the stylus is like the Wacom Bamboo, which is a favorite of mine.
Right. I like that one.
And yeah, it's a really cool stylus. And then we will have the brush style tips and these various wide tips and disc tips and all these other stylus tips that we're seeing right now. I think they're going to start going away.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, well, I guess that's CES in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yep, that's it.
Seems like a pretty small nutshell for such a big to-do.
Yeah. Yeah, well, next year it will be a much more interesting show, I think, because by that point I think we're going to see a lot more wearable tech happening.
Yeah, I think we'll see lots of people trying to copy Apple.
Right.
Because we both think that Apple's going to do something this year.
This year. It's coming. Whatever it is, it's coming.
Right. All righty. Well, what's our next topic? Our next topic is...
Should we talk about Judge Coat?
Yeah. This is sort of like the listener call-in, the listener request show.
Yes. And when we say the listener, we mean the listener.
Well, Neil Pan, the noted architect... suggested two topics for us, and that was talking about Judge Coat and net neutrality, and we thought that we'd do both.
Right. So there you go. It's the...
Yeah, we're open to suggestions from everyone, by the way.
Right, not just Neil. Yeah, but thanks, Neil.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Woo! Let's see here. Judge Coat. We had a little bit of movement in the Apple's ongoing feud with her and her monitor, Michael Bromwich.
Mm-hmm.
And she ruled on Apple's motions that, first of all, they don't need a monitor in the first place. And second of all, if they've got to have one, it shouldn't be Michael Bromwich.
And she told Apple they're wrong on both counts.
Yes, her movement was talk to the hand. Hashtag whatever.
Was it whatever or whatevs?
Whatevs. Don't make me cough or don't make me laugh. I'll start coughing.
Sorry. I'm trying to be very, very serious.
Boy, we just sound awful, though, don't we? Folks, we actually feel a lot better than we sound.
That's true.
It's totally true. So, yeah, her ruling was, I think I pretty much made the right decision putting a monitor in place, and I chose the right guy. And that's about all there is to it. If you really have any complaints, you need to work them out with either Mr. Bromwich or the Justice Department, Department of Justice.
Which is exactly what she's been saying for a while now.
Right.
So she hasn't changed her stance at all.
No. And none of this should be surprising. It shouldn't be. I doubt it was surprising to Apple. Here's the deal. It is very clear that Michael Bromwich is doing precisely what Judge Coate wants him to do. And it is very clear that Apple thinks that that is a mistake. And that's why we have so much friction between these parties. And that is why this is going to end up going to an appellate court.
Yes. And Apple's going to be swinging their big sticks the whole way. They are not pleased with this. They don't want to have a monitor in-house. They don't feel it's necessary. And they clearly don't like what the monitor is doing. So they're going to be pretty hardcore through all of this.
Yes. Yes. And, none of this was a surprise. None of this really changes anything. This is all going to have to be decided by an appellate court. And if the appellate court says that Judge Coate made the right decisions and that her verdict was correct and et cetera, then you know, Apple's eventually going to have to come to grips with having a monitor and having this disruption. It's for Apple fans, it's a real drag, but that could well happen. I still think that Apple will win on appeal, but that's because I still don't understand why Apple was found guilty in the first place.
I agree with you. I think Apple's going to win on appeal. And while it's very possible that Judge Coate's ruling across the board is totally appropriate, it sure doesn't feel that way. And it sure seems like there's enough experts out there that are that are in agreement with us that I really have to question whether or not there's some vital piece of information that's been withheld from the public that justifies the harsh ruling that we have going on here.
It does feel like there's missing information because it doesn't make sense. And you know how I feel. When you see something that doesn't make sense, when someone is acting in a fashion that appears irrational to you, almost always there is a piece of missing information that will, if not necessarily make you agree with the actions, will at least make them not be crazy, appear crazy.
Right. Or at a minimum will allow you to understand why they're doing the crazy thing.
Right. Exactly.
And we're missing whatever that key piece is. And my guess is the reason we're missing it is because it's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's interesting. I don't want to get into the appearance of impropriety aspect of this because I don't think I'm qualified to talk about that.
No, I don't think either of us are. Yeah. Although I have played an attorney on stage before,
and I've watched several cop and lawyer shows.
Oh, we're totally qualified.
the real news here is that there wasn't much news in all the news about this. Made lots of headlines. There were lots of headlines about how Apple's ploy or Apple's. I saw several headlines saying that how Apple lost its effort to get the monitor thrown out or removed, but that wasn't going to happen. I mean, that was never going to happen from these motions. These motions were all about satisfying this step through Judge Coates so that they can then be appealed.
Right. And had Apple presented their arguments to Judge Coates, and she sat back and was like, holy crap, you're right. I really screwed this up bad. Guys, so sorry, my bad. Let's fix it all now.
Yeah.
That was not going to happen.
No. No, it wasn't, because, I mean, she clearly has a reason for what she's doing. I don't know what that reason is, but she clearly has a reason for it. It's just, you know, of course she rejected the motions, and that's just all there is to it.
Right.
Next step, appellate court.
Right. And Apple has been doing everything that they need to do so that they can walk in and present the case that they need to present to the appellate court.
Yeah, and let's remember that Apple's attorneys aren't irrational either. Apple believes that it can win this. This isn't just a case. I don't think, at least, that this is a situation where Apple, Tim Cook is just like, you know, who are you to tell me what to do? I'm Tim Cook. We're Apple. We're the greatest American company. Steve Jobs is our founder. He's a hero. He just recently died. Leave us alone. You know, I don't think this is anything like that. I believe that Apple's leadership believes that they acted in an appropriate fashion, that the deals that they made were rational business deals that were effectively very day-to-day kind of deals, and that their attorneys believe that they can win this on appeal. I don't think Apple is going to be wasting its time if they didn't have a very good reason for thinking that they could win.
Yes. And if they were fighting this case on principle, well, they aren't. They just simply aren't. But
I think they're outraged on principle.
They're outraged on principle, sure, but that's not the same thing as fighting the case on principle. Right. Had Apple's executive team told their legal department, we don't care right or wrong, we're fighting this on principle, the legal team would have come back and said, yeah, no, that's a bad idea, because whenever you fight a case just on principle, you are going to lose.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they put together all the pros and cons. I'm sure there are actual legal terms for this, but they've done a risk analysis and you know, they've got a legal strategy that they think that they can use to win.
Right, and it's not on principle.
No, I don't think so. But definitely. You know, Michael Bromwich has talked about the fact that an unnamed director told him that Apple's leadership was just outraged at the conviction and the imposition of the monitor, all that sort of stuff. They're definitely outraged on principle, but I don't think that that's the source of the fight.
I agree. That can't be the source of the fight. Mm.
All right. So we also have net neutrality also in the courts.
Yes, and it's an unfortunate ruling, but unlike what some people are insinuating, this is not the end of the road for this fight.
No. So what happened is an appeals court. So Verizon, actually, we've got to back up even further. The FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, set up rules in basically enforcing the concept of net neutrality on internet providers. And net neutrality is the idea that all traffic gets treated equally. And the internet providers don't want that. They want to either be able to give their own services preferential treatment, mm-hmm. or at the very least, they want to be able to charge for preferential treatment, right? They want to be able to they want to be able to charge Google for the privilege of having YouTube videos shown faster than, say, Netflix movies or Vimeo videos or Flash videos or whatever,
or or to throttle all of those videos in favor of their own on-demand video services.
Yes, exactly. And so basically, the internet providers, and Verizon has been the most vocal one on the legal front. They want the freedom to be able to use money to decide who gets to see what when.
That's kind of a sad and creepy idea.
It is, in fact, a sad and creepy idea. And I think a much more rational approach to this is to have internet net neutrality, as it's called. And that's, again, where everything is created equal. So your request to a YouTube video has no more priority or no lesser priority than my request for a New York Times article or, or a Vimeo video or a Kickstarter video, whatever. And that to me is a much more rational choice. And that to me is the only way to keep the big players from owning everything and basically imposing a significant barrier to entry to any new players who want to provide any kind of content.
And that's key, the way you said that. Any kind of content.
Any kind of content. Any kind of... Without net neutrality, the internet providers become the gatekeepers of who it is that you get to... what it is you get to watch or consume on the internet. And because they're the gatekeepers, what that really means is that whoever has the most money is going to have better access to your eyeballs than anyone else.
You remember,
and that ain't right.
No, it's not right. And it reminds me to a degree of the old days of internet service where we had like AOL and CompuServe, and they were very walled gardens. And the content that you got to see, if you were an AOL subscriber, was whatever content AOL deemed appropriate to allow into their system,
sure,
which favored their own content.
Right. And right. You used to have to go through like a little, like a sort of reverse portal to get to the so-called World Wide Web.
Right. And yeah. And so you would request through AOL to be able to see whatever a web page was, and they could choose to let you see it or not. But regardless,
and it was always much slower than AOL's own content too.
Right. So I see that sort of a system coming back if we can't find a reasonable net neutrality option. Now, the part where it's not dead yet, what the government or what the ruling said was that no, the way the FCC put this together, that's the part that's wrong. What they need to do is figure out a way to do it that better fits within the guidelines of that have been set up to govern the FCC. So once they figure that out, then they can move forward and they can still give us net neutrality.
Well, they didn't. Maybe. They didn't quite put it that way. The problem is that the FCC screwed the pooch. The FCC ruled that that the internet providers are common carriers. This is a I don't know if it's a technical, I don't know if I should say it's a technical term or a legal term or simply a regulatory term referring to entities which basically sort of serve the public at large. And so they ruled that they're common carriers while at the same time ruling that they're not subject to common carrier rules.
Right. So that means the FCC has to figure out a different way within their parameters to regulate this.
Right. And that, that's going to require some changes for sure. But the big reason why this isn't as much of a big deal as some sources made it out is that this appellate court also ruled specifically that the FCC does have jurisdiction to regulate this area in the first place. And Verizon had also challenged that. Verizon was saying that the FCC had basically had just no jurisdiction, no business telling them what to do here at all. And the appellate court said, nope, that's pretty much the FCC's job. And that means that the FCC can they can appeal this ruling, although they may not want to because of that aspect of it. Or they can just find a new way of enforcing net neutrality that doesn't use the previous methods that they did. And I'm hoping that that's going to happen.
I hope that's going to happen, too. And the second half of the ruling is the part that gives me hope. Saying that the FCC does have a regulatory authority here. That's
important.
It's huge. So huge.
That's what she said. I weighed that, and it came out in favor of saying it.
And you made me laugh, and you made me cough, and
yay! We really do feel better than we sound.
We really, yeah. clearly, well enough for Brian to make a "That's what she said" joke, and for me to appreciate it.
Yay! Let's see here. Now we have one more topic.
It's a topic that has me a little bit sad.
Well, you know, it does. And it's funny. So the topic is Google buying Nest for $3.2 billion with a B dollars. And so before we get off into that aspect of it, there's one thing I've noticed. Do you remember how everyone was like, you know, Nest is cool.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The thermostat, way cool. Oh my God, that's cool. The smoke and carbon monoxide detectors, oh my God, way cool.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was really excited about them. Everybody has loved them all along. It was Tony Fadell, the father of the iPod. You know, here's an ex-Apple executive who's gone on to do something successful and really cool outside of Apple. And now Google buys them, and people are like, well, you know, first of all, there are lots of people who are like, okay, I'm no longer going to use my Nest. I get that because they're worried about Google getting the even more data about them, and now data about their, you know, their homes and everything. But I'm reading, and this is JF Billy, right? Longtime reader. He's been a big part of the Mac Observer readership for a long time. But he asks, why does the thermostat need to be connected to the internet, even the smart one that knows when you're home and when you're not? I mean, because Google has bought this company, many of the same people who were very keen on this product are just like instantaneously turning against it.
Well, it's the product is, in that case, I think, is simply a symbol, and they're against Google, and this is just is the avatar they have at this moment. The reason it has to be connected to the internet is because you can remotely control your home.
Yeah, there are huge reasons, and even just remotely monitoring your home.
Right. Yeah, it can send you notifications. Like in the case of the smoke and carbon monoxide detector, if you're not at home and something goes wrong, like there's a carbon monoxide buildup in the house, you'll get a notification letting you know about the buildup, where it is in the house, and the fact that the thermostat just shut off your smoke detector sent a message to your Nest thermostat, which then shut off the furnace.
Yeah. Yeah, and look down the road when this stuff has been tried and true, you know, and has been honed through experience and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's basically, you know, has gone through the fires of actual use, pardon the use of fires there. And to, you know, look to the date when these devices can communicate directly with the fire department.
Oh yeah.
You know, all kinds of reasons to have something like this connected to the internet. This is just in response to JF Billy's, question, but, it's been interesting to see just how quickly people have turned on how some Nest fans have turned on the product and the company for doing this. And part of me doesn't blame them, because I absolutely positively have been beating the drums and have a real problem with the way Google collects so much data about us.
Sure. And I don't like the feeling I get knowing that one company has so much information about my personal life. And it just, it concerns me because I have no way of knowing how secure that information is. And I have no way of knowing really what they're doing with all the data about me.
That's right.
I mean, it is completely out of my control.
Skynet knows all.
Yeah. And I don't like that. That said, I would still love to have a Nest thermostat and Nest smoke detector, because the technology is still amazingly powerful and amazingly useful.
Yeah, and you know, they say Nest says that the company will remain independent, and they also insisted that data will not be shared. Actually, what they insisted was that data will only be used to improve the products. Now, I see plenty of wiggle room there for improving the product, meaning that now the data is being collected with Gmail and your flight, you know, your flight schedules there's plenty of room for Google to use that data in that instance.
Yes. And I can see where it could be used for good. Like with Google Now, it knows your flights. It knows your travel arrangements. Yep. So let's say when I was supposed to fly out for CES and my flight was canceled, when I left my place, if all of this stuff was linked together, Google could have told my thermostat, go ahead and drop the temperature down. Jeff's going to be gone for a week. When it found that my flight had been canceled, then it could have sent me a message. Hey, do you want me to warm the house back up? Are you on your way back? And I could say, no, I'm not yet. I might still get a flight out. But then when I was truly on my way back home, it would know that. And then then at that point, even without me interacting, it could turn the heat back up. So I'd come back to a nice warm house.
That's right.
And I mean, stuff like that I see as really valuable. But
right. And we're not, that doesn't exist yet, but this is something that could happen conceivably in the future.
Sure. And I haven't said why I'm sad about this, and everyone's assuming it's all about the personal information being given up. And that's not it. For me, it's because Google has a track record of taking products and killing them.
Yeah, but this is a lot different, man.
It's a lot different, but it's not. What I could see Google doing at some point is saying, yeah, you know, the way Nest did it, that was great. But now we have the Google stat that's going to go on your wall. And so now everyone needs to buy that. And because we're doing the system a little bit differently, all of your Nest thermostats are no longer compatible, so they don't work.
They could. I don't see that happening. And you know, the difference between Google launching a product and canceling it is those have always been internal products. And they have usually been internal products that were started as part of their 20% plan.
I have to offer up SketchUp. SketchUp started as a Boulder company.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yep. And it was a great product. Google bought it. And then one day they were like, yeah, we're done with this.
You're right.
And it wasn't until another company said, hey, Google, can we just buy that off of you, that SketchUp had a chance at life. And SketchUp is still out there. It's owned by a different company now. But, yeah.
You make it's a good point. I stand corrected. Well, I don't think that'll be the case.
And I hope it's not the case. It's just, it is a concern that I have.
Fair enough. But so here's the real question. Why did they pay $3.2 billion for this company? That is an astounding figure to me. I mean, Nest is cool. Nest is cool. I've been a fan of Nest since the moment I saw that gorgeous one dial thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I clearly went gaga for the smoke detector that they released up in the Nest Protect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But $3.2 billion, I mean, that is just so much money. That's a lot of money even for Google.
It is. You know what the most expensive company Apple ever bought has been?
Next.
And they paid $404 million for that.
Yeah, and that wasn't admittedly in 1996.
Right, but even if you adjust for inflation, you're not going to hit $3.2 billion.
No, nowhere near. I think someone did an article, someone in another publication did an article saying that Google paid more for Nest than Apple has paid for its top 10 biggest acquisitions of all time.
Wow. Okay, so that would be combined.
Combined, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of money. So, Google,
I don't understand how Nest is worth that much money. I mean, they can't be doing more than $10-20 million a year in sales. I guess they could be doing more than that, but I'd be shocked if they were. I'd be shocked if they were doing $100 million. And I mean, I know they've got a lot of potential. I know they've got some great ideas. They certainly have some great engineering talent. They're doing some really cool things, but $3.2 billion, oh my goodness, that is so much money.
I love Nest, but I think that they way overpaid. And now I have to wonder, at some point, will their shareholders be flipping out over this and questioning whether or not the company acted in a fiscally responsible manner?
It doesn't matter, man. Larry Page has locked up control of that company so well. It doesn't matter what the shareholders
That's a good point.
Think.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
But, I'm sorry, buying Motorola and grossly mismanaging Motorola is a far bigger crime than paying $3.2 million for Nest. Buying Motorola for $12.5 billion, effectively doing nothing with that company, having no success with the patents that they got with it, again, for $12.5 billion, that's a much bigger problem.
Yeah, that's a really big problem. Yeah, I have to assume that what Google is doing here is looking at their very long term plans, and so by buying Nest now, even though it's $3.2 billion, they're getting it at a bargain price compared to what it would cost them when they really did need to have it.
Well, so we know Recode, that's Kara Swisher's and Walt Mossberg's new project now that they're no longer with the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. They reported in, I think, the first week of January that Nest was close to closing out a new funding round. I mean, this is part of why I question the valuation of the company, because they're doing little enough business that they still needed outside investor money. Right?
Right.
And yet they're worth $3.2 billion. But anyway, they were close to closing a new round of venture capital for $150 million in a valuation that would have put the company at $2 billion. And that was just a couple of weeks ago. And, obviously $3.2 billion was the number that was needed to get everybody to be willing to sell the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that standpoint, you know, something is worth what you pay for it.
Sure.
So, you know, just everybody must see a lot of potential with what they're doing. Now, we're running out of time, but we should mention the elephant in the room, or the elephant that's not in the room, and that's Apple. Why didn't Apple buy this company?
It makes sense to me that Apple didn't buy this company. Apple makes computers, and they make smartphones, and they make tablets. They don't make home appliances. They don't make thermostats. They don't make refrigerators. They don't make... that's not a focus for Apple. That's someone else's purview.
It's true, but expanding into home automation is one area that Apple could do well with. As a matter of fact, they may already have plans to do that. And that may be why they were selling the Nest through the Apple stores, because they wanted to see who was buying the product.
That could be. Apple has in the past used other companies' products for their own research.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But here's the important thing. If Apple had wanted to buy Nest, Apple would have bought Nest.
Right.
So there are people who there was crowing about how Apple lost out.
They didn't lose out.
Yeah, they didn't lose out. They chose not to do this. I mean, I guarantee you. So understanding that Tony Fadell and I think it's Matt Rogers was the other Apple VP that founded the company. Understanding that two of the principals at Nest came from Apple and had good enough relationships with Apple still to get their product in Apple stores. Understanding that, you have to understand that that Apple knew that they were for sale and had the opportunity to bid on them.
And chose not to.
And chose not to. Recode also reported that Apple was not a serious bidder. So I'm guessing that there were talks. I mean, there's probably always, quote-unquote, talks.
Sure.
You know, with companies like this. So I'm sure that there were talks at some point, but Apple wasn't seriously interested in the company. And if they had been seriously interested in the company, they would have bought them. That's all there is to it. So Apple did not lose out. Apple wasn't interested, and there's a huge, massive difference. Now, Tony, I do think that Tony Fadell is a very, very talented man, and I do hate the fact that he's going to Google. I'd rather see him back at Apple, but so be it. I wish him success, and I wish Nest success. Although I'm probably going to be a little bit less interested in using the products, to be honest.
Yeah, it's. I hope the Nest stays a relevant and successful product.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll have to see.
Yes.
We'll have to see. All right, well, so we did miss last week's show because we were at CES, but we obviously we're back this week, and it's good to be back in the seat, and good to talk to you again, buddy.
Yeah, it's always a special treat. Every single week.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And if this glass wasn't here between us, I'd hug you right now.
Oh, I can feel the hugs even now.
Yeah. They radiate right through the glass nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Take us out.
Okie doke. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. And feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamut, both places.
And you can follow me on Twitter at TMO Brian. That's Brian with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at The Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by The Cashfly. The bass is by The Boom, recorded just for the TMO. And that's all for this week.
And if you haven't made it over to the iTunes store yet to give us a rating, please do that, because we love it when you do. And
indeed,
stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at The Mac Observer.